Welcome to our second session with Dr. Jack Opperle on the topic of four women you should never forget. Today, he'll talk about Corrie ten Boom, the innkeeper. And now Jack will open us with prayer.
Nice to be with you today. And as we begin, let us seek God's guidance in prayer. Let us pray. God, we have readied ourselves for this morning, and we also acknowledge our dependency upon your grace and your understanding and your support, as well as your direction. And so open us to your spirit that we might think and speak those issues and ideas which are yours, through Christ our Lord. Amen. This morning we look at Corrie ten Boom. I'm sure many of you have seen the movie or the TV presentation, The Hiding Place. It is her signature work that describes what she did during the Second World War to care for Jewish refugees primarily. I think it's kind of timely that we look at Corrie ten Boom today, because this week in our city, a jury is being paneled that will examine the fate of the man who inflicted such pain upon the Tree of Life's synagogue several years ago. Anti-Semitism is alive and well. And of course, in the life of Corrie ten Boom, anti-Semitism was a driving factor. You kind of wonder what it is that drives a person to risk everything as she did and ultimately pay the price for her involvement with the Jewish community. What was it that motivated that kind of intensity and dedication? And the simple answer this morning is this: it was her family. Her family believed that the people of Israel, the Jews of every nation, were the chosen people of God. And beyond that, that family believed that it was their purpose in life to provide security and safety and understanding and haven for those chosen people of God, and more importantly, to learn from and be enhanced by their suffering. Corrie ten Boom learned to care about the Jewish nation and the chosen people from her family. She was born in 1892 into a marriage between Caspar and Cornelia ten Boom. There were four children in that family, and Corrie was the youngest. Her father's dad was a watchmaker, bless you, was a watchmaker, and he had opened a business in the country of Holland, where he had lived for most of his life. Unfortunately, he died very young, just about a year after Corrie herself was born. And therefore, she never really knew her grandfather. But she knew this about her grandfather. Early on in his life, his pastor had come to visit the watchmaker. And this was the purpose for the visit. He was aware that there was a growing sentiment in Germany and in the Netherlands against the Jews. And he invited Corrie ten Boom's grandfather to begin to pray for direction and understanding as to how it was that he was going to relate to that issue. Growing up out of that visit, her grandfather organized a prayer group. They met weekly, and their single focus was to concentrate on the Jewish community. Her parents were married in 1884. And they moved to a small town where her father, like his father, opened a jewelry business. That family is worth our noting. Every day began and ended with scripture reading and prayer. From her mother, she learned this fundamental lesson: it's noble to care for people. It's extraordinarily noble to care for people who in some way have been diminished. Initially, she taught her children to care for those who were diminished in terms of body injury or mental limitations. And off of that, Corrie Ten Boom, as a young kid, began to pray for people that she identified in her thinking as needing those prayers. And guess who the first group was that she prayed for? No, it wasn't the Jews. It was the drunkards, which she saw on the streets of her small town, seeing them as impaired people needing God's grace. And from her dad, she learned the lesson of hard work. She also learned the lesson of doing it correctly. And beyond that, she believed and was taught the purposes of honesty and above all, truth. And her dad, not a trained theologian, but obviously a believer, taught her that those lessons were valuable and important to implement. Why? Because they were God's message for her age. Early on, the family began to be interested in the Jewish neighbors that they met in their small town. And that relationship became so significant, it became so warm, that after a while, the Ten Blooms were invited to come to Jewish celebrations. They often attended Sabbath with their Jewish neighbors. They were invited to come during Passover. And suddenly the family became integrated, not only into the awareness of the Jewish community, but beyond that, participation in that community. Corrie Ten Boom once said that she learned that Jews had names and that they had mothers and dads, that they had laughter in their homes, that they were real people. And as a result of that, the Ten Boom family was widely respected by the Jewish community. They moved back into the larger cities of the Netherlands, and they eventually took over the business that Grandpap had begun. It was a business that was dedicated to the finest watch that could possibly be made. One of the memories that Corrie has of her dad and of their family living in this larger city was that every night, her dad came into their room, her sister and she, and he would tuck them into bed and say with them a prayer. Tuck that thought away as we anticipate learning about Corrie Ten Boom's experiences in German concentration camps for women. The family was very highly regarded. They were people who had an enormous standing. And after the First World War, the Ten Blooms thought about this insight into the Jewish community. They became aware that the nation of Germany, coming off of that First World War, was subject to all kinds of dangerous behaviors. They had lost the war. Beyond that, they had been treated badly, and there was growing a sentiment in the Jewish population within Germany that danger was near. As a response to that, the Ten Boom family actually began to bring German children to their home in Holland. And there they restored them to not only physical, but also emotional and mental health. They invested in the future of Jewish children by caring for German kids who were suffering beneath the weight of a lost war. The children mattered in the Ten Boom family. And there were scores of them that came and went over several years. In the midst of their caring for children, some changes began to occur in that family. For example, her brother Wilhelm became interested in the ministry. And so he went off to theological school, where he prepared himself for a task of ministry. And while he was there, he was required to write a senior thesis. His senior thesis was written upon his concern that perhaps in the country of Germany, there awaited forces that would produce the most significant pogrom, the violent destruction of an ethnic group ever in history. Are you ready for this? His professors mocked his choice, saying that could never happen there. Likewise, Corey herself became interested in theology, and she went off to a Bible college where she studied Old and New Testament and church history and dogmatics, et cetera, et cetera. And that education was interrupted by her mother's untimely death, which brought her back to her family home to work with her dad in the jewelry business. And guess what? In that context, Corey Ten Boom broke another glass ceiling. She became the first woman watchmaker to ever be licensed in the country of the Netherlands. And so after a while, it was Papa Casper, it was Corey and her older sister, Betsy. Because you see, Wilhelm and Noli, the two other children, had married and gone off to begin their own family. And in the context of a dad and two daughters living and working together, these are some of the priorities that were established. Number one, Corey and her sister began a school for young girls. They believed that girls were not being properly educated in the Netherlands system. And so they began to offer a school for young women. Then they decided that maybe it was kind of dumb to offer a school only for young women. And so they developed a school for co-eds. And their overarching position was that education needed to be equal and available to everyone. These young girls and these young men were also taught the meaning of God. It was important to the Ten Boom family that all of life be perceived in the context of a loving and caring God. And so it was that life was good. Corey was a watchmaker, working with her father in a relationship that she prized and cherished. Beyond that, their life had become rich in terms of investing in their community. Beyond that, they began to sense an opportunity to make a difference in a projected fear of a terrible event. And of course, in 1940, that terrible event began to unfold in their native country of Holland. It was in 1940, exactly on May the 14th, that Adolf Hitler dropped his first bombs on Rotterdam, destroying that city, pounding it into ruin and ashes. And when the violence ended, 900 people had been killed. Aren't those motorcycles scary? I am so sensitive to that these days. When we were living in Reading for a couple of months there for a while, and down there, that's the big thing. And they are absolutely frightening. I mean, the sound is kind of like, oh my God, what's going to happen? And when they get up close to you, you really get nervous about it. Anyway, in Rotterdam, violence of the Third Reich began to have its way. And that had an enormous implication for the Ten Boom family. Number one, they were one of the few families in the country who had a telephone. Suddenly they realized that the telephone was not working all the time. And when it was working, there were clicks that could be heard. Number two, their mode of transportation was a bicycle. They had five of them. All five of those were confiscated by the Nazi regime. Number three, they had to go to the local municipal building and get an identification card. And the purpose for the identification card was to say that they were or were not a Jew. Number four, This family who had established itself so significantly in the community were now asked and told that if they wanted food, they would have to apply for a ration card in order to qualify. More than anything else, they began to notice some of their closest friends, the Weinsteins, the Abramans, and lastly, the Wells, all Jewish, were gone. They just simply disappeared into the night. The ultimate threat to the Ten Blooms occurred around their radios. Most people in Holland had one radio. They had two. And therefore, when the Germans came to confiscate the radios from people, which would then keep them from hearing the broadcast coming out of the free world, Ten Blom surrendered up one. But the second one they kept. And they actually built a secret place under a staircase where they kept the radio so that they could stay in touch with the broadcasts coming out of the free world. Of course, after a while, they began to notice something else. Their friends who were Jewish, who remained in their city, were now wearing the yellow Star of David. It was required. And more often than not, when there was someone found beaten on the street, or if there was some encounter in the neighborhood, guess what? More often than not, it involved someone wearing that star. The dad, the watchmaker, the fellow who taught his children about honesty and integrity and hard work, decided he needed to make a statement. And so he volunteered to wear a yellow Star of David on his coat as he moved about in the community. He completely and at great risk identified with those who were indeed being targeted. This put Caspar Ten Bloom, as well as his entire family, as well as his address, on a list of suspicious people that ultimately would bring havoc to his family. One night, they heard their neighbors, the Wells, who had a small store that sold clothing and shoes and those kinds of commodities, crying out in the night. And when they went over to see what was the problem, they were stopped by Gestapos, the soldiers of Hitler. The little store had been completely decimated and broken. And the last view that they had was of the Wells being wrestled to the ground and their neck being pushed into the cement by the boots of the Gestapo. At enormous risk, Caspar Ten Bloom, wearing his coat with the yellow Star of David, intervened and rescued his neighbors from the violence of that evening. They were taken into their home and they were sheltered there and they were hidden there. They contacted their son, Wilhelm, who now began to understand his ministry as being someone who would be involved in establishing the channels by and through which Jews could leave Holland and migrate to safer environments. They contacted their son, who arranged for the Wells to be exported out of the city to safety. Think about that. At enormous risk, at public identification, Caspar Ten Bloom began what would become a family business, the business of providing for Jews safety, haven, and above all else, a passage out of danger. The Ten Blooms began to see some very ugly things in their community. And I raise them this morning because I think perhaps from time to time they could be seen in ours. They began to see, for example, that there were anti-Semitic words being painted all across the city, on buildings, on walls, on payments, and they noticed something else. Those ugly words never went away. They noticed something else. In many of the stores that they patronized, they began to see the sign that read, "Jews will not be served." And the 10 balloons began to realize that they were living in a cauldron of hate, violence, and ultimately death. Their closest friends invited them to join an organization that was known as the National Socialist Bund. The National Socialist Bund. It was a group of people who came together to discuss the circumstances under which they were living. Caspar Tenbloom attended, and he came home realizing two things about the Bund. Number one, there were many people who joined the Bund simply because it afforded to them the opportunities for a better job, or perhaps for more food rationing coupons, or then again, for better housing. They joined this organization primarily to support and enhance their own families. Here was the second thing he learned. Some of his friends actually believed in the hate and the violence and the anger that was growing up in that city against Jews. And so they decided that something needed to be done. What they decided to do was to become a shelter, a haven, a place where Jews could hide. And beyond that, they began to develop the networks to get the Jews to safety. They prayed about that. And I don't introduce that concept lightly, because for Corrie Ten Boom, her prayer was not a simple, dumb thing that just asked for God's help. Her overwhelming prayer as she entertained her involvement in this struggle was this: could I be a person who lies? Because lying was involved. When the soldiers came to the door and said, "Do you have any Jews here?" the answer was no, even though there were four or five of them up in the attic. Could she lie? Number two, could she steal? Because it was necessary from time to time to steal things in order to make the program work. Number three, she wondered if ever she could kill. If she would be presented with the option of a Jew versus a German dying, which would she choose? After weeks of praying over those kinds of very difficult questions, this was the answer that Corrie Ten Boom decided she heard. Anytime, anywhere. She became so convinced of the horror and the mindless hatred that was occurring in her environment that anytime, anywhere, she was prepared to lie. She was prepared to cheat. She was prepared to steal. And if necessary, she was prepared to kill. The family needed to build some level of security into the home that they were using as a kind of terminal. And so an architect friend of theirs came into their home and looked over and decided they could build a secret room up in Corrie's bedroom. And so he set his skills into operation, and believe it or not, they were able to construct an area that was totally and completely safe. In fact, over the years that the Ten Blooms operated this situation, never once did the Gestapo find that room. Never once was it found. Number two, they also devised a code system. For example, oftentimes when they were sharing across the telephone whether or not the Jews in their house were safe, this would be the conversation: "All of our watches are safe and secure." They were skilled at opposing the Nazis. Number three, they also held drills so that when the knock came at the door in the middle of the night, the people who were staying in that house could get to that sheltered secret place as quickly as possible. These people were skilled at what they attempted to do. After a while, one knock became two knocks, and then four knocks, and then five knocks. The Jewish community learned about the Ten Bloom Haven, and they began to use it. Some of them stayed one night, some of them three nights. There were some who became permanent guests. It didn't matter to the Ten Blooms. You could stay as long as you needed to be safe. And that became their commitment. One night, Hori was awakened by her sister, Betsy. A Jew had come needing some money in order to buy the papers to get free. Corey Ten Bloom sent one of her trusted aides the next morning to a bank to withdraw some money from her account to make that possible. After the transaction was completed within 3 hours, there was a Gestapo at their front door. They were all arrested, father, two sisters, and they were arrested because of the hand of a man whose name was John Vogel, V-O-G-E-L, a trusted friend, someone who knew them intimately, someone who had joined the National Socialist Bund, and after a while had become indoctrinated in the hate. The family was broken apart, women sent off in one way, Casper the male into another. They would learn later that their dad, Casper, only survived 10 days in captivity. His age, the frailty of his body, and the treatment that he received caused his death. Betsy and Corey were sent off to a prison. And in that prison, they lived in filth, they lived in hate, they lived in all types of mindless hatred that one could not imagine. And in that context, her older sister, Betsy, suggested to her younger sister, Corey, that their primary task was not to become people of hatred, violence, or resentment. And so these two sisters, as they began their pilgrimage in the German punishment system, dedicated themselves to remaining faithful Christians, capable of forgiveness, of love, and of peace. It was not an easy journey. And this morning, we don't have the time to walk through all of the specificities of their captivity, but I think we have to hear about a couple of them. Number one, in the local jail where they were kept for about 6 months, they shared a cell with seven other women. Think about that. Seven other women, nine of them all together, living in a space that had no facilities at all. Their food was a piece of bread that every now and then was thrown through a trapdoor. And that is how they lived for months. Think of the challenge that must have been to retain some level of peace and love and grace. After a while, they were told to gather up what few possessions they possessed, and they were few. And they were loaded into a boxcar with over 100 other women. If you've ever been to the Holocaust Museum in Washington, D.C., you'll appreciate that little bit of information. For in the Holocaust Museum, as you know, you go in on the ground floor and then you take an elevator up to the sixth, and then ultimately the tour works its way back down. And when you get off of the elevator on that sixth floor, you immediately enter into the interior of a boxcar. And you realize a couple of things. You don't see out. You realize the limitations of space. There is no lighting. And that is how Betsy and her sister, Corey, were taken to Rauschenbruck, which was the notorious prison for women located just outside of Berlin. It was a long journey, living in darkness, having no idea what was going on around them, excepting the sounds of the engines. And eventually there they were in Rauschenbruck, this terrible prison for women. The prison served as their hotel. They were assigned a bed in Barracks 8. And they shared that bed with three other women. The bed primarily was a bed of straw, mostly infested by human feces and fleas. And that is how they lived. In the day, they were put into trucks and they were taken into local factories. And they were forced to work 12 and 15 hour shifts, lifting heavy steel plates, et cetera. And when they were brought back, they were put back in Barracks 8 with the human feces and the fleas. And what was the response of Betsy, the older sister, to that environment? She, along with her sister Corey, began to hold nightly worship services. Now, they were modest services, a hymn, a bit of scripture from memory, and maybe a few words of assurance and hope and promise, the praying of the Lord's Prayer, and then the quietness of night. One afternoon, Betsy said to her sister, Corey, who was beginning to be agitated, angered, and frustrated by what was happening to her, "You need to learn that there is goodness in everything." The younger sister responded, "How could there be goodness in this?" The older sister responded, "The fleas. The fleas." And she went on to tell her sister that the fleas should be a reason for her thanksgiving. Of course, the young sister was absolutely confounded by that and finally asked the question, "Why?" And this was the response of the older sister. "Have you noticed? The guards do not come into the barracks to disrupt our worship services. Because you see, they were afraid of being inundated by these fleas and infected by disease. And as a result, the fleas, in Betsy's mind, became a kind of blessing." Think about the faith, the insight, the intellect, the awareness that that conclusion required. In our culture, most of us find it intolerable when the internet is down. Or we find it beyond endurance whenever the air conditioner goes out. Think of what it must have been like to find a reason for thanksgiving in a flea, because it kept the German soldiers from interrupting worship. Their environment was filled with all kinds of things that would have destroyed most people. There was the constant smoke from the crematorium that had a very clear and distinct aroma. There were the cries of torture, women being dragged out into the yard at night and raped, beaten, and sometimes killed. Corrie Ten Boom, in her wonderful book, The Hiding Place, remembers her years with her sister in this prison camp for women as a moment of mindless suffering. She once wrote that unless you had experienced it, you could never understand it. Eventually, Betsy became ill. She developed a severe lung infection, probably a pneumonia. She was carted off to the local infirmary where there was some level of treatment to be provided. Eventually, her sister Corey was summoned to the infirmary and told to get her out, that they had done all they could do. Nothing had worked. In fact, Corey always believed that nothing was even tried. And therefore, she carried her sister in her arms back to Barracks 8 to share that bed with three other women. In the first night back in the barracks, her sister expired. And she never did learn what happened to her sister's remains. Those remains were left out in the street in front of the barracks and was picked up, probably put into a crematorium the next day. 12 days after that terrible event, Corrie Ten Boom received a discharge notice from that prison. She later learned that her discharge was actually a clerical error that a secretary had made, and that indeed all of the people with which she had been normally identified as a group had been put into the crematoriums and killed. Immediately, you see, Corrie Ten Boom saw in that the hand of God. And she did not see the hand of God as something that spared her. She saw the hand of God as something that said, "You have more to do." It wasn't so much that she had been rescued from the fate of losing her life, but rather that she had been mandated to make of her life something of enormous significance. And so it was that she prepared to leave the camp. And it required that she be in good health before she was returned to her native city, because the Germans did not want any bad public sentiment. They discovered that her ankles were swollen, that her legs were filled with edema. And so they withdrew the discharge. And she spent several days in the infirmary. And finally, the doctor said, "You're well enough to go, leave." And she left on a train on her way to Berlin. Believe it or not, as she was making her way to Berlin, suddenly the train stopped. And the reason for the stoppage was simple. There was no track left. And the track had been bombed by Allied bombers. And suddenly the people that she always thought about would save her were ironically the people who had in fact kept her from getting out. The track was repaired because it was the link for the German supply lines. And she continued on her journey to a city called Groningen, where she spent 4 or 5 days in a hospital. Those 4 or 5 days allowed her to send a message with a friend back to her sister, saying that she was on her way home. She was finally released from the hospital. The tracks were repaired. The train ran again. She got her way to Berlin, was able to get transportation to Holland. And after 2.5 weeks of anxiety, she arrived back home, where her sister, now her only surviving sibling, her only surviving family member, along with her two daughters, had spent time preparing the house for the return of their beloved Corrie. She immediately, of course, took up the family business. She was a watchmaker, a jeweler. And so she reopened her father's business and began to serve the needs of the community. However, Corrie Ten Boom never forgot what her sister had taught her. It was two things. We must share with the world what happened to us, because it's the only way people will learn of it. And number two, we must never let the world forget what happened to the Jews. And that concept, those two concepts revolved around in her mind and finally produced in Corrie Ten Boom what we, most of us, know about her. She became known as the Tramp of the Lord. In fact, that's one of the books that she has written, entitled The Tramp of the Lord. She traveled all over the world, telling the story of the family next door, of the hundreds of Jews that went through their home, of what happened to her and her family because they aided and assisted these people. She became a spokesperson, a tramp of the Lord, shouting to the world the sadness of these events. She also opened up a facility in the city of Berlin. And in that facility, she cared for people who had been harmed and permanently disabled by the results of the Nazi movement. Of course, there were lots of Jewish people who came through that facility, but listen to this. She also provided for Germans who had been deeply harmed in so many ways by the environment in which they had found themselves. She provided for them the opportunity of health and wholeness and freedom from their demons. She learned that her brother had been killed by a German Gestapo agent, and that his son, a young man of 19, had also perished. But they did not learn about that for over 10 years. They had no idea of where he was. And as Corrie Ten Boom made her name and her mark on the world stage, she faced a tremendous test. One night in 1947, she was giving a speech in Munich, Germany. The speech was designed to deal with those two concepts. We must never forget, and we must not become like what happened to us. After the speech was over, a man in a gray overcoat came up to her. She immediately recognized him. He was the most violent, hateful guard that she and Betsy had encountered while incarcerated in that women's prison. He extended his hand toward her. And she writes in The Hiding Place that she waited for over 5 minutes, wondering what she should do. Think about the dilemma. This was a man who had probably beaten and raped them. This was a man who was known for his stick. And suddenly he stood before her, extending a hand of friendship. She remembered her sister, Betsy, and how Betsy found a blessing in the fleas. She remembered how it was that on the night that Rotterdam was bombed, as she went into Betsy's room, she found Betsy on her knees, yes, praying for their city, but also praying for those German pilots who were inflicting all of that pain on that city. And as a result of those memories, Corrie Ten Boom extended her hand toward the guard, and they grasped each other's hand. This is what she wrote of that. It was a moment in which the celebration of God's love was more intense than I had ever known before. There's another experience in her book that she writes about. It has to do with John Vogel. Remember him? He's the guy that turned them in. He was their friend, their colleague, someone they trusted. And he was the man who betrayed them, gave the address and how to get in. She also forgave him, this time at her instigation. She actually sought him out and told him that he was forgiven. Those two events really characterize what Corrie Ten Boom is really all about. It is remembering the horror that we can inflict upon one another and turning our back on that, choosing not to participate. And number two, always seeking to share with the world the broken, the lost, the hurt, the dead, those who have been violated. Corrie Ten Boom eventually migrated to America. She lived in Southern California. And there she continued to travel. There she continued to write and to be a kind of a prominent figure in the Christian world. She began to suffer a series of strokes, one of which ultimately took her life on April the 17th, 1983, 92 years to the day from which she was born. She's buried in a very small plot in a cemetery in Los Angeles, and it simply has on her tombstone these words, Corrie ten Boom, a grateful servant. So we could spend a lot more time. Sorry, just give me a few more minutes and then we'll go on from there. We could spend a lot more time talking about the specifics of her experience. Probably most of you have read the book, The Hiding Place. If you haven't, you should, and it's probably in your library. But let me share with you some things I've thought about in terms of making this choice and then working on it. Number one, it is something I've referred to earlier, and that is the rise of anti-Semitism in our culture. You can't deny that. It's everywhere. It's on buildings. It's in acts of violence. We've seen it in our own city with the Tree of Life Synagogue. It tells the story of human life hatefully ended. But here's the other part about the Tree of Life Synagogue. Maybe you saw it on the news recently. That building is going to be taken down. And on that property, that congregation is going to build an information center, a cultural awareness center, as well as a synagogue, a place of worship. Their purpose is that no one should ever forget. Or then again, no one should ever think it couldn't happen here. And perhaps Corrie ten Boom is a person who reminds us of the importance of those two concepts. It can happen here. It has happened here. And as people of faith, we are called to respond. Number two, I think it's pretty easy to make judgments about people who inflict those kinds of pain on others. But I think we have to be careful there. Because sometimes when we make judgments about others, we implicate ourselves in ways that are very sad, in that sometimes we become as hateful as they are, only for different reasons and with different targets. I'm interested in remembering why it was that people joined the National Socialistic Bund. Yeah, some of them joined because they thought it was a good idea and they wanted those Jews out of there. Others of them joined out of senses of fear, anxiety, survival, who knows what. Be careful how we judge one another. Number three, I think it's important to also indicate that human life has a name. This is what the ten Blooms learned. They are moms, they are dads, they are children. They are colleagues. And when I think about the Tree of Life Synagogue, I think about Alvin Berkin. Alvin Berkin is the rabbi emeritus of that congregation. And he and I, for 10 years, worked together at Channel 4 doing a television show that aired on Sunday mornings. We were good friends. And it occurred to me when I read about the Tree of Life tragedy, one of those names could have been his. People have names. They have reality. They are real. They have relationships. And we must never, ever, ever forget that. And let me close with this simple statement. An old retired watchmaker, Casper, his two daughters who never married, Corrie and Betsy, a son and his son made quite a difference in the world. By some estimates, between 800 and 1,000 Jews escaped Nazi prison camps because of the ten Boom family, that house with that secret room and that radio hidden under the staircase. Never underestimate the impact that you and I and all of us together can have for good in the world. Apologize for going over. Maybe you have some thoughts or some ideas. And here comes the man with the microphone.
Incredible. Thank you so much. I guess my question is, you know, people say, well, how can God let these things happen? What does this tell us about God? What should we know about God?
Let me see. I have an answer to that somewhere. I wish I knew the answer to your question. That was my question when my mother died at 78. When mom died, 75 at the age of 57. Why? She was a good mom. She was a good grandma. She was an excellent pianist. She was a woman of faith. What's up with you? I think what we have to deal with around that issue is something that Paul Tillich, the theologian of the last century, addressed. He once talked about the fact that many of us believe in something he called the God of the gaps. And what that means is we seek to utilize God when we don't have an answer. You know, God caused it, God let it happen, God's role in it was, and we define that. And Tillich suggested we ought to move away from that concept of God. And what we ought to see is that for Christians, isn't it interesting that God revealed Godness through Jesus Christ, who happens to have been a Jew, who was also born in a stable, who was rejected by his time. I'm sorry, I don't subscribe to the notion that it was a nice big plan. I come out of a school that says Jesus was not crucified between two candlesticks. Jesus was crucified between two thieves, and he was the victim of a system that could not tolerate difference. He challenged too many sacred cows. So that when you look at Jesus as a revelation of God, what do you see? I think you see vulnerability. I think you see sadness. I think you see, you know, Jesus wept. Think about the words of Jesus. Have you been with me so long and you still don't get it? He didn't speak those words to the high priest. He spoke them to his best trusted friends. So to answer your question, I don't think God did allow it to happen. I don't think God made it happen. I think it happened. And for me, the role of God in that whole tragedy is somehow seen in the miracle of a person who, after what she went through, extended her hand to that German guard. That's God. So I wish I could be a little more, you know, helpful in giving you a reason as to not giving any of us a reason why bad things happen to good. And by the way, that's a good book too. When Bad Things Happen to Good People. Anybody read that? Oh yeah, it's a marvelous book. And why was my 14-year-old son afflicted with this disease and died? Think of how many times that question has been asked. I think it has to do with getting beyond the God of the gaps. I really do.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I fear there is something dark inside us that wants to separate us from our neighbors. And you look at our history, we were just watching somebody talk about the Japanese internment camps. You look at the Native American situation. You look at the names we're calling the people who are coming north from the border. There's something inside us that wants to say, you know, somehow they're different from us and they don't deserve our compassion. I'm always cautious whenever I make any kind of a comparison to the you know, Hitler's times, because that's probably on a different scale, but I'm not sure it's a different spirit. And So we have to just make sure that we don't fall into that again. And I don't think that's God. I think God is the thing that helps us to move away from that and look after each other. So I do not think we can blame any of that on God, any of the bad stuff.
It's also interesting that perhaps we could call it sin. And when we call it sin, I'm not referring to the devil. I'm referring to hubris, which is actually the Greek word for sin, which we also can translate as pride. Mm-hmm. So I sometimes think that when we ask the question, why did something happen? I think it has to do with a sense of misplaced pride that says, and I have to include this. I've always found it interesting that Adolf Hitler said, we must have an Aryan race. Blue-eyed, blonde-haired people. You ever take a good look at him?
Right.
Black hair, brown eyes, and he was short and skinny. So that's that to me was a hubris expression. And I think a lot of our sins, we can talk about the same issue relevant to African-Americans. You're black, you're bad. We can talk about that in terms of Japanese. We can talk about it, and I think we can talk about it in terms of all kinds of violence that occurs in our in cultures. It's not God. I don't think God calls us to that, and God doesn't want that to happen. God's not out there doing that, I think it's our hubris. It's our sin. And I don't think that, I don't subscribe to the notion of a devil concept, because that's just putting it onto another identity. Who was it? Andrew Greeley, who once said, most people, when they sin, what is their response when they're found out? The devil made me do it. No, he didn't. You did it yourself. Yeah. There was a question in here. No? Anybody else have a comment or a question? Well, I guess I better get out of here.
We got one more.
One more over here.
Hang on.
Maybe somebody else knows this for sure. I think there's a movie, The Hidden Room, that's coming out maybe this summer, or maybe it's a series right now. Does anybody?
No, I'm not mindful. What was it? What is it called?
The Hidden Room.
The Hidden Room.
Or The Hidden Place.
Oh, okay. I don't know that. Can anybody shed light on that? I'm not aware of it. Is it to be a televised thing or? Okay. It'll be interesting to see if there's any correlation to Corrie ten Boom. They sure have borrowed the image. Yeah. Well, yeah. Keep an eye out for that one. Next week, we're going to take a look at Rosa Parks, Lady on the Bus. We didn't give up her seat. And I'll give you a little background on her, and we'll look at the implications that had for the civil rights movement in America. Okay. Thank you for coming today.